Hello, this is Mary, and I'll be reading selections from the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, November 18th, 2024. From the front page of the paper, Environment in Illinois. Pollution may stall silver carp. Study: Illinois river water near Chicago slows invasive species. By Nara Schoenberg, Chicago Tribune. In a name-your-poison twist, a new study from the University of Illinois adds to the evidence that Chicago-area waterway pollution is slowing the relentless advance of the invasive silver carp. Researchers turned their attention to a section of the Illinois River about 50 miles from Chicago, where the silver carp's progress stalled out more than 10 years ago, with the formidable fish holding its ground, but failing to continue on toward Lake Michigan. The researchers took water from a more polluted section of the river, not far from where the carp stalled, and put young silver carp in it. Instead of moving around and exploring, as they did in clean water, the fish slowed down almost immediately. It's sort of a coping mechanism, said study co-author Corey Suski, a professor of natural resources and environmental sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. You kind of hunker down and hope that whatever is bad in your environment is going to pass by. The authors also found that the silver carp burned more energy in the polluted water, a sign that their bodies were fighting the effects of contaminants. Suski co-authored a previous study in which silver carp from the Illinois River showed gene activity consistent with contaminant exposure. Now we've got a bit of a mechanism, Suski said. If the fish do swim further on, the contaminant loads are probably going to be a little higher, and it's going to be energetically costly to be there. It almost becomes like it's not worth it. They're spending more energy to keep themselves safe than they are possibly taking in. Other factors that could be causing the Illinois River carp to stall include shoreline changes such as walled riverbanks closer to the city, downstream carp fishing, and locks and dams. There are a lot of different things in play that could be preventing the carp from moving forward. But now, some stimulus in the water should also be on the list, Suski said. The study didn't identify which contaminants are affecting the carp. Among the suspects, volatile organic compounds and substances not removed by wastewater treatment plants, such as pharmaceuticals. It's possible the researchers could figure out which substances deter carp, Suski said, and that information would have practical benefits. Not to say that we need to start polluting, he said. Pollution is not a good carp deterrent, but we might be able to say, there's something that they don't seem to like. Is there some way we can use that? Silver carp and bighead carp, both of which are stalled about 47 miles from Lake Michigan in Shanahan, outcompete native species. Government agencies are working to stop them from entering Lake Michigan, where they could harm native fish and the $7 billion Great Lakes fishing industry. Invasive carp arrived in the U.S. from Asia in the 1970s, imported to eat algae in commercial fish ponds. They escaped and have been spreading through waterways since the 1980s. It's definitely one of the most challenging conservation issues of our time, in part because it's so widespread across the Mississippi River Basin, which reaches into 31 states, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesperson Janet Lebson. A few invasive carp have been spotted closer to Chicago than the stalling location, but those fish are viewed as isolated explorers, rather than members of a population front on the move. In 1922, a silver carp was found in Lake Calumet, about 7 miles from Lake Michigan. In 2017, a silver carp was found below T.J. O'Brien Lock and Dam, about 9 miles from Lake Michigan. And in 2010, a bighead carp was found in Lake Calumet, Lebson said. The main line of defense in the Chicago area is an electric current barrier system near Romeoville and about 30 miles from Lake Michigan in the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. Construction of a major addition, the long-awaited $1.2 billion Brandon Road Interbasin Project deterrent system on the Des Plaines River near Joliet, is expected to begin early next year. Another major initiative, invasive carp fishing by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and its partners, removes about 1 million pounds of fish per year from the state's waterways. Study co-author Amy Schneider noted that the water quality in the Chicago area has been improving, and a lot of the native fish found in the Eleanor River are doing fairly well in the Chicago River and its tributaries. It's possible we could see silver carp move upstream if the water quality improves, she said. Keeping an eye on them and trying to predict what aspect of the water quality is affecting them might give us some insight as to when and why they might move upstream in the future. Turning to page 2, Two Kids Saved in Well Rescue by Tony Reed. Taylorville. A dramatic rescue saw Taylorville firefighters free two children who had fallen into a well and were trapped 15 feet down. A news release from the Taylorville Fire Department said the rescue happened Saturday afternoon in the grounds of a home in the city's Bertinetti subdivision. The children, a 14-year-old girl and a 2-year-old toddler, had apparently fallen through a covering over the well, and their cries for help were heard by people nearby. The children were plucked from the 18-inch wide well using a pre-made rigging system, and the entire rescue took about 10 minutes. The children emerged unharmed, but were later checked out by medical personnel. One firefighter was listed as having suffered minor injuries. Almost no progress reported so far at World Climate Summit by Seth Borenstein, Associated Press. Baku, Azerbaijan. Distractions were bigger than deals in the first week of United Nations climate talks, leaving a lot to be done, especially on the main issue of money. In week one, not a lot of progress was made on the issue of how much money rich countries should pay to developed ones to move away from dirty fuels, and how to cope with rising seas and temperatures and pay for damages already caused by climate-driven extreme weather. But more is expected when government ministers fly in for week two to handle the hard political deal-making at the negotiations, known as COP29, in Baku, Azerbaijan. Countries remain about $1 trillion a year apart in the big numbers to be settled. All the developing countries look very united behind $1.3 trillion. That's not a ceiling. That's what they want. That's what they think they need, said Debbie Hillier, policy lead at Mercy Corps. The U.S. and Canada are constantly talking about a floor of $100 billion. So you've got $100 billion at one end and $1.3 trillion on the other hand. While poor countries have come up with a number for the total financial package, the rich donor nations have assiduously avoided giving a total, choosing to pick a figure late in the bargaining game, Hillier said. The intention of developed countries to really come clean and show commitment is missing, said Harjeet Singh, Global Engagement Director for the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. They have not uttered a single word on what the final total is going to be, which is very disturbing. Especially when it comes to this total, United Nations Climate Secretary Simon Steele said negotiations on key issues need to be moving much faster. What's at stake here in Baku, Steele said, is nothing less than the capacity to halve emissions this decade and protect lives and livelihoods from spiraling climate impacts. At this moment, the sides are far away, which is sort of normal for this stage. The technical details that are worked out by negotiators now have to give way to bigger, harder number decisions made by climate and finance ministers to make more political decisions, said Ani Dasgupta, president of World Resources Institute. Member states have not moved, and parties have not moved as expeditiously as they need to, said United States Environment Protect Program Executive Director Inger Andersen. This is causing frustration. I understand that. So the answer is to push and push more and ensure that we land where we need to land. Andersen said it's not smart to judge where countries will end up after just 1 week. Things change. It's the nature of how negotiations are designed, experts said. That's how it usually goes. COP works on brinksmanship, said Avinash Persaud, a special climate advisor at the Inter-American Development Bank. COP works on the fear of us not reaching agreement in the end, which makes the process appear chaotic from the outside. Ministers will also be consulting with their bosses half a world away and 7 hours behind at the Group of 20 Countries, the G20, in Brazil from Monday. The G20 is made up of the world's richest nations, which are responsible for 77% of planet-heating gases being spewed. Usually the second week is when the CO president takes over and pushes sides together for a deal. Different negotiations presidents have different styles. Last year's president used sharp elbows to get things done, upsetting some people. That's not the style of this year's COP president, Mukhtar Babayev. What I see with Mukhtar is he uses a gentle presence, a degree of humility in his very presence, Andersen said. But Mohamed Adao of the think tank Power Shift Africa said, the presidency is not giving any hope for how he will help the world strike the right compromises. Also from page 2, Community Health Workers Spread by Ariel Zients, KFF Health News. Huron, South Dakota. Kelly Ingebrigtsen was excited to get fitted for a prosthetic after having part of his leg amputated, but he wasn't sure how he'd get to the appointment. Natu's twin sons needed vaccinations before starting kindergarten, but she speaks little English, and the boys lacked health insurance. William Arce and Wanda Serrano were recovering from recent surgeries, but the couple needed help sorting out their insurance and understanding their bills. Ingebrigtsen, Wynn, Arce, and Serrano were fortunate to have someone to help. They're all paired with community health workers in Huron, South Dakota, a city of 14,000 people, known for being home to the state fair, and what is billed as the world's largest pheasant sculpture. Three workers employed by Huron Regional Medical Center help patients navigate the health system and address barriers like poverty or unstable housing that could keep them from getting care. Community health workers can also provide basic education on managing chronic health problems such as diabetes or high cholesterol. Community health worker programs are spreading across the U.S., including in rural areas and small cities, as health providers and state and federal governments increasingly invest in them. These initiatives gained attention during the coronavirus pandemic and have been found to improve people's health and access to preventive care while reducing expensive hospital visits. Community health worker programs can address common barriers in rural areas where people face higher rates of poverty and certain health problems, said Gabriela Faquer, who oversees community health worker initiatives at the National Rural Health Association. The workers are an extension of the healthcare system and serve as a link between the formality of this healthcare system and the community, she said. The programs are often based at hospital systems or community health centers. The workers have a median pay of $23 an hour, according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. Patients are typically referred to programs by clinicians who notice personal struggles or frequent visits to hospital emergency departments. South Dakota is among the states that have recently funded community health worker programs, develop training requirements for the workers, and approve Medicaid reimbursement for their services. The state certification program requires 200 hours of coursework and 40 hours of job shadowing. Huron Regional Medical Center launched its initiative in fall 2022 after receiving a $228,000 federal grant. The program is now funded by the nonprofit hospital and Medicaid reimbursements. Huron, a small city surrounded by rural areas, is mostly populated by white people, but thousands of Karen people, an ethnic minority from the southeast country of Myanmar, began arriving in 2006. Many are refugees. The city also has a significant Hispanic population from the Caribbean, Mexico, and Central and South America. Mickey Scheib, one of the Huron's community health workers, recently stopped by the house of client Kelly Ingebrigtsen. The 61-year-old hadn't been able to work since he had part of his leg amputated due to diabetes complications. Scheib helps with the hoops you've got to jump through, such as applying for Medicaid, Ingebrigtsen said. He told Scheib he didn't know how he was going to get his prosthetic fitting in Sioux Falls, a two-hour drive from his home. Scheib, 54, said she would help find him a safe ride. She also invited Ingebrigtsen to a diabetes education program. "Put me down as a definitely absolutely," he replied, adding that he'd invite his mother to tag along. Turning to page 4, the Life section, a television Q&A, what's ahead for Jesse Stone? Question, will there be a 10th Jesse Stone TV movie? I heard a rumor that one was coming out in 2024. Answer, fans have long wanted another Stone movie starring Tom Selleck of Blue Bloods and inspired by the novels by Robert B. Parker. 9 movies aired between 2005 and 2015, the first 8 premiering on CBS and the 9th on the Hallmark Channel. Selleck also had a hand in writing many of them. All 9 are on the Roku channel, Prime Video, and DVD. Selleck has kept the door open for a possible 10th movie, with reports at times that he was working on a script. In an interview last spring, and published in October, where he discussed life after the end of Blue Bloods, he said, "It looks like now I might have to write a new Stone movie. It wouldn't be a final one, because everyone loves it. Jesse is a great character, and it would be fascinating to find out where he is quite a few years later. I don't know what's next, but assuming the phone doesn't stop ringing, I'm going to have to keep working." Question, do you have any information about the return of All Creatures Great and Small to PBS? Answer, A fifth season of the series, based on the books by James Herriot, is coming to Masterpiece on January 12th. According to the show's website, a new trailer shows that both James and Tristan will return to Derrowby. What circumstances will bring them home, and how will they adjust? We know nothing more than the joy that their return brings. Other than that, animal hijinks, Mrs. Hall in uniform, and a deliciously adorable baby Jim round out this long-anticipated look at the upcoming season. Question. After I saw Jeff Bridges on Stephen Colbert's show, I tuned in to the second season of The Old Man on FX. I loved it. Looked for the first season, and nada. Where can I watch all of it? Both seasons of the series, starring Oscar winner Bridges, are on Hulu. It's not yet clear if there will be a third season. Box office lukewarm on big budget Red One by Lindsay Barr. Moviegoers were not exactly feeling the Christmas spirit this weekend, or at least not based on their attendance at Red One showings. The big budget star-driven action comedy with Dwayne Johnson and Chris Evans sold $34 million in tickets in its first weekend. It easily topped a box office populated by mostly holdovers. For traditional studios, a $34 million debut against a $200 million-plus production budget would be a clear indication of a flop. Some even pegged the budget closer to $250 million. But Red One is an Amazon MGM Studios release, with the luxury of playing the long game rather than relying solely on global box office, where Johnson tentpoles often overperform. The film may have a life on Prime Video for years to come. Red One, in which Johnson plays Santa's bodyguard, was originally built to go straight to streaming. It was greenlit prior to Amazon's acquisition of MGM. One interpretation of its life cycle is the theatrical earnings are not only just a bonus, but an additive gesture towards struggling theaters looking for a consistent stream of new films. It is certainly not a hit in North America. Red One was roundly rejected by critics with a dismal 33% Rotten Tomatoes score. Jake Coyle, in his review for the Associated Press, wrote that it feels like an unwanted, high-priced Christmas present. Therapy gave Mariska Hargitay her life back. Mariska Hargitay credits Therapy for giving her her life back. The Law & Order SUV star was 3 years old when she and her two brothers were in a car accident that resulted in the death of their mother, actress Jan Mansfield, and she admitted it took until adulthood before she was able to process her grief. Speaking at the Hope for Depression Research Foundation seminar at the Plaza Hotel in New York City, where she was honored with the Hope Award for Depression Advocacy, People magazine reports she said, "I lost my mother when I was 3 years old, and I grew up in a house of people dealing with the tragedy in their own way. And because there was so much grief, there wasn't room to prioritize anyone. We didn't have the tools we have now to metabolize and understand trauma, understand all the levels, understand that it goes in on the cellular level. So it wasn't until much later in my life when I was able to do that for myself. It wasn't until much later that I found the language to acknowledge it for what it was." Turning to page 5, National News. Bergam likely to reinvent interior by Jack Dura, Associated Press. President-elect Donald Trump has chosen North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum to head the Interior Department. Here are some things to know about the two-term Republican governor of a sparsely populated state. Burgum, 68, grew up in tiny Arthur, North Dakota, population 328. He earned a bachelor's degree from North Dakota State University and his master's of business administration from the Stanford University Graduate School of Business. He went on to become a wealthy software executive. He led Great Plains Software, which Microsoft acquired for $1.1 billion in 2001. Burgum stayed on as vice president until 2007. He's also led other companies in real estate development and venture capital. In 2016, Burgum ran for governor, his first campaign for elected office. He touted a message of reinventing government as the state dealt with a massive revenue shortfall. In a major upset, Burgum defeated North Dakota's longtime attorney general in the Republican primary. He handily won his first term in the strong Republican state, which has about 784,000 residents. He was easily reelected in 2020. Burgum has taken a business-oriented bent as governor of North Dakota, where agriculture and oil are the main industries. He's pushed income tax cuts, reduced regulations, and changes to animal agriculture laws and higher education governance. Burgum also emphasized a data-driven approach to governing, advocated for a Theodore Roosevelt presidential library in the state, and prioritized engagement with tribal nations. Burgum and his wife, Catherine, have been public about her recovery from addiction. And as governor, he has prioritized resources for an addiction treatment. He is known as a policy wonk who works long hours and is highly inquisitive. He has largely resisted wading into social issues, such as anti-LGBT measures pushed by members of his own party, vetoing a few such bills in 2021 and 2023. But also in 2023, as he was planning a run for president, he signed a pile of bills opponents said targeted transgender people. They included a ban on gender-affirming medical treatment for transgender kids, sports bans for athletes, and transgender restrictions in schools. Burgum ran for president from June to December 2023. He campaigned on priorities of energy, economy, and national security, but dropped out after his bid failed to resonate. From page 6, the sports section, around the NBA. NBA, Tatum traveled before game winner. Jason Tatum traveled moments before making the deciding three-pointer at the buzzer to give the Celtics a victory over the Raptors on Saturday. Tatum moved his pivot foot with 3.4 seconds left in overtime, and should have been called for traveling, the NBA revealed Sunday in its last two-minute report. The NBA also said Toronto's Davion Mitchell should have been called for a foul against Jaylen Brown with 7 seconds left. Brown would have gone to the foul line with the game tied. Bucks. Coach Doc Rivers was fined $25,000 by the NBA for public criticism of officiating after a foul against Giannis Antetokounmpo that the referees said they got wrong. Hornets, LaMelo Ball was fined $100,000 for making what the NBA called an offensive and derogatory comment in Saturday's post-game interview. Ball used an anti-gay slur. And the stat of the day, the Lakers' Anthony Davis has reached the 30-point plateau 8 times in 12 games this season. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review from November 18th. Please stay tuned.